Overlooking Phoenix, from high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios, Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Brought to you by OfficerPrivacy.com, the company's officers trust with their online privacy. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two retired cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And we have just another great show for you. We have a SWAT expert, Sergeant Kyle Schoberg. He is going to talk about shootings and the conference that's coming up in Arizona as it relates to SWAT. He is a firearms expert. He's been there. He's been in multiple shootings. And how timely for him to talk to us, because in the next segment in Cop Talk, we're going to talk about Alec Baldwin. In my personal opinion, we're talking negligence. We're not just talking, you know, reckless and accidental. We're talking negligence. We're talking him going down. And then in the last segment, we're going to go lighthearted. We're going to have loony laws, heroic headlines, and Jason's always inspirational closing message. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained after this word from our sponsor, Officer Privacy.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
We both signed up for the service and are so happy with it. OfficerPrivacy.com is offering a very special deal for listeners of the Badge Boys. This is a great deal. Go to OfficerPrivacy.com/BB. Their team of current and retired law enforcement officers will remove your information from the top 30 sites that are showing your home address, your phone number, and so much more. When you sign up now with our link, you'll get a free bonus mailed to you, plus your first month of monitoring for free. You don't have to be an officer to sign up. If you are a family member or just don't want your personal information out there on the internet, you can join OfficerPrivacy.com. We've met the owner, had him on our show, great guy, and he will take care of you, I promise. If you care about your online privacy, and I highly recommend the service he provides, sign up at OfficerPrivacy.com/BB.
Well, my. We happen to know that guy.
Criminals think they are so smart. The problem for them is the police are smarter. Detectives resolve things. They don't give up. I'm not the only one who answered the call.
I am retired Sergeant Darren Bird.
Detective Chris McMullen.
Detective Frank Dillard.
Robert Cushing, Vermont State Police.
Now, where did he come from?
Every detective has that one case. This is that one case for me.
He thinks he can outsmart these detectives. Well, he has another thing coming.
You're not going to be able to run from it.
You want to find that smoking gun.
He does what he was made to do. Find the bad guy.
That is, as they say in tennis, game, set, and match.
American Detective.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
I just love being here in studio with Jason Schechterly. You were gone a few weeks, and it's just not the same, my friend. It
That's
just
true.
Isn't. I mean that.
I hate not being here, trust me. And it feels good today, especially since we have guests in studio, which is even better. And I know you're getting ready to talk about our awesome sponsor, who in a matter of hours I'll be driving to Vegas for that Wounded Blue conference that we talked about last week, and Pete James is going to be there, so I'm going to spend time with him.
You know, it's so neat because when we do these different events, and I was at the
Bleeding Blue
mm-hmm. premiere in Phoenix, and of course again Pete James is there as well. He is involved in every aspect of what we do, and that's why we always talk so much about the police side of it. He was a sheriff, a lieutenant with Sacramento, and he was involved in the forensics as it relates to computers, so he knows what he's doing, and his heart is blue, and he truly cares about police and their family, especially in today's era where there's bad actors doxing us, they're harassing us, they're auditing us, I'm using air quotes, they are there are some really bad actors out there, so you need to be careful. And again, officerprivacy.com/BB or /badgeboys. You get a discount, you get a month free, you get a gift that helps keep you safe. There's so many things. But I know, Robin, you want to talk about this as well. You're biting at the bit to talk about, and you always help us out on the civilian end of this.
I always tell everybody, look, this just isn't for police officers. And I know Pete has talked about it before, that half of his clientele are real estate agents or people like me who are public figures who don't want to be recognized in the private sector. We don't want people knowing where we are. And it's so important what they do. And the thing I love about Pete, even though he's the owner of the company, there's a lot of personal outreach with him. He goes to these events. And my funny little thing, I told him I was going to give him grief about this, but I happened to walk past him during the Bleeding Blue premiere, and I heard him tell the young lady next to him, "There's Robin." And I turn around and he goes, "I'm Pete, you know, Pete James. I don't know if you remember me." And I looked at him. I said, "Dude, I know who you are. You're the show sponsor. How could I forget you?" So the entire night, it was funny because we would go past each other. "Who are you again? Do I know you?"
But this is a running gag.
And he's such a personable guy. And I told him, I said, "I'm going to do a shout out for you. I'm going to pick on you just a little bit, but I'm going to be nice about it," because he is a nice guy. And when I first signed up for it, I was late to the game. I'm the producer of the show. I should have been on board from the beginning, but like everybody else, sometimes I procrastinate, think I can do it all myself. And there's places I found myself that I had removed myself from, and that scared the hell out of me. And it's nice to be able to actually have somebody that's going to sit down, and Steve is my guy. He does it for me, and I don't have to worry about anything. And then every month they send you a report. Here's where we removed you from.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's perfect what I want to speak on, which is that monthly report. I, too, have Steve. He's my go-to guy.
Nice.
And I'm all suddenly I'm back all over the place because of that show and ID channel, The American Detective. So now all suddenly people are putting my name back in it, and voila, they completely clean me out of the system, those 30 top sites, and then bam, overnight, I'm back in them, and they clean me off those sites again. So I can't stress enough, we all here at Badge Boys, you go to officerprivacy.com/BB or /badgeboys, you get a discount, but more importantly, you have that sense of security for you and your family, and that's priceless.
And there's one more thing I want to add to this, because you brought up a good point with me, Darren. There was something that still is not able to be removed for me, and you told me to bring it up to Pete. And while he was at this event, I actually had that conversation with him, and he gave me instructions on how to get it out, because unfortunately what they provide cannot eliminate this particular thing. And I'm not going to go into detail, but if it's something that's still showing up that can't be taken down, just ask Pete and he'll advise you on what to do. And he gave me the perfect remedy to it, which now I got to get my ass in gear and get it done.
And you're right. They are absolutely not just a one shop deal where you're done. They stay with you. They truly care. They're all law enforcement retirees or current law enforcement officers that do this work, that keep you clean on the internet. Talking about law enforcement, you got a great guest for us, do you not, Jason?
Yeah, I could not be more excited than looking forward to this week. I think me and Kyle started talking on social media at least a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago. We have in the studio with us Kyle Schoberg. He is a police sergeant in Northern California, 14 years of law enforcement experience, 7 years as a canine handler, which he started in 2014, assigned to that unit, currently serves as the supervisor. During his time in K-9, Kyle worked with the SWAT team. He is Peace Officers Standard Training Certified in SWAT and K-9 Interacting Drug Deployment, a.k.a. SKIDS. I love the monikers that we come up with. Wouldn't that be cool to be on patrol and be like, "Hey, can you call the SKIDS unit? Like, badass, please, I need help." Kyle's been a part of numerous critical incidents, including direct involvement in 4 officer-involved shootings. That's a lot. Over 500 canine deployments, 60 canine apprehensions. He is a recipient of several police commendations, awards, most notably 2 Medals of Valor, the Distinguished Service Medal, and a life-saving ribbon for saving the life of another officer shot in the line of duty. Kyle currently presents to numerous law enforcement agencies regarding officer wellness, nothing more important than that right now, and he openly debriefs his officer-involved shootings. Kyle, ma'am, I am humbled to be in your presence. That is outstanding, and welcome to the studio.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, as a person who has been out of law enforcement for a long time, and my critical incident is very different than what others have been through, I will respectfully ask, of your four shootings, which one or two are you do you most think are pertinent to what officers are going through right now? What can be learned from them, both from the physical as well as the mental and emotional side?
All of them are pretty unique. You know, all of them involved some type of gunfight involved in all of them. The one that stands out to me the most probably is going to be my last shooting that I was involved in, 2019. I was involved in a foot chase with a guy that went to our local mall and shot his gun in the mall. And me and another officer responded there. And obviously I was a canine handler at the time. And this officer that I went there with was 1 week off of field training. So he's brand new. Wow. And we show up in the parking lot, see the guy running through the mall parking lot. So we chase in our vehicles. And at the time, he actually had nothing in his hands. And so he's running. And I end up catching up with him in my vehicle. And when I caught up to him, he stopped running. And I thought he was going to surrender. And so, you know, I got out of my car and drew down on him, told him to get down. He just stared at me, gave me this 1,000-mile stare. And I'm within a few feet of him. And he turned around and took off running again back towards the mall. And there's a restaurant. And it was about 6 p.m. In the evening, so there were in the summertime, so there were several people out and about. And he started running back towards the mall. And so, you know, I deployed my dog, Axel. Still had nothing in his hands. Told him, you know, get down. He didn't stop running. So I ended up deploying my dog, and at which point, I don't think he even saw my dog, actually, but that's when he turned around, pulled the gun from his waistband, started shooting at me. And I think his first round, maybe his second round, ended up hitting me in the vest on my left side. And my dog at that point caught up to him and went up to bite him. And then that's when he realized the dog was, you know, about to bite him. And he turns and shoots at my dog right point blank in the face. And my dog, and this guy had a .357 Magnum. And so, you know, a big gun, very loud, went off in the dog's face. The dog goes back. I actually thought he shot the dog, and I thought my dog died right there. And that was traumatizing in and of itself because, I mean, those dogs are like our kids, you know. And to watch someone shoot my dog like that, I mean, it's hard to describe, but it was in the moment. I was traumatized. I couldn't believe what I just saw, and I was super angry. And so I'm returning fire at him. He's running, and ultimately the dog ends up kind of coming back into view and re-engages him and bites him in the calf, pulls him down. And mind you, we're running down the sidewalk, basically just shooting at each other, you know, like the Wild West, no cover, no nothing. And so my dog ends up pulling him down. The other officer, Joe, at the time, you know, the brand new guy, he's now coming around. He's also firing at him. And my dog is on the bite. We're shooting. And I get within probably 4 feet of the guy, and he sits up and points the gun right at me and shoots two more rounds right towards me. And honestly, I thought that was it for me. I mean, I'm looking down the barrel of this gun, and yeah, I thought I was done. And I end up shooting the rest of my magazine right there, which ends up hitting him. His last two rounds that he shot at me went whizzing past my head, hit the building behind me. And, you know, I retreat to cover. He's down. I can't even see my dog anymore because he's behind this little hedge. And I thought for sure, based on all the rounds I shot, plus my partner that was there, all the rounds that he shot, I thought for sure I shot my own dog. And that in and of itself, too, you know, when I was running up and I saw my dog biting him and him pointing the gun and shooting at me, knowing I had to shoot him with my dog on the bite, I assumed that I was going to be shooting my own dog, and that was also traumatizing. So it was like a double whammy for me regarding my dog, you know, having to make the decision to basically shoot my own dog to save my own life. That was tough. But you know, so long as the short is, I'm behind cover now. Another patrol car shows up. I'm calling my dog. He's not coming back to me. I'm telling my partner, hey, my dog's, he's down. You know, which is unusual for my dog. He would always come back if I called him off a bite. So he's not coming back. And, you know, I just assume that we shot him. And so maybe a minute goes by, which doesn't sound like a long time, but it's a long time.
It's forever.
Forever, yeah. And so finally the dog comes, Axel comes running back to me, and I was pretty shocked. I grab a hold of him. He's covered in blood, you know, so I thought, all right, he's shot. I knew I had been hit. One of my other canine partners arrives on scene, and, you know, I'm telling him, hey, my dog shot. I got hit. I'm stripping my uniform off, you know, to check myself, and I realized my vest, you know, the vest had took the round. And so now I'm more worried about the dog. We end up taking him to the vet, and they scanned him. He didn't get hit one time. He got, when the suspect shot at him originally, point blank, when he went to bite him the first time, the round skimmed off his muzzle and burned him. The muzzle blast, I think, burned him in the face. But other than that, those were the only injuries that he sustained. So that to me obviously sticks out the most. You know, and then, yeah.
You know, I've been in a shooting, and I can't imagine being in four shootings. I really can't. Mine was in 95. And the question I have for you is the difference from your first shooting in terms of policy, in mm-hmm. terms of the way they treat you back then. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, the psychiatrists have to see afterwards. Yeah. We're talking about the days off, you know, administratively. We're talking about the walkthrough with homicide as well, depending on the situation, if your guy died.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so you have to walk through with homicide, then you have the internal affairs. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the first shooting and what year that was and this last one? And then after that, I'd like to talk about the emotional. In mine, when my guy died, I was sad. I genuinely was sad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine you being sad about the slash guy, because he was going to take out your partner. If you could talk about those two differences, if you will, from the first shooting to the last.
Yeah, well, like you said, you were sad. I mean, yeah, I was too. And this kid was like 20. He was in his early 20s, you know, and he looked like a teenager. So there's definitely a side of empathy in our job, and I've learned to have that over the years. But the difference between my first one, you know, that my first one was in 2015 and my last one was in 2019. So in a period of you know, 3.5 years, I was in four shootings.
Wow.
Myself. But, you know, being on the SWAT team and deploying with those guys, you know, we got into a shooting on our SWAT team where I was there. And so in a very short amount of time, I was involved in these incidences. You know, obviously the first time I had no idea what to expect. I think cops are a little naive in the sense of, I think we like to believe that that's probably not going to happen to you until it does. And then someone's shooting at you and it's like, oh shit, is this really happening? And, you know, what I train is you have to be able to be prepared for that before going into it. Because it's inevitable. And every shooting that I've been involved in, you know, you'll always have officers that don't engage. And, you know, I truly believe that it's just because mentally they're not prepared for that, right? So when it actually happens, your stress levels skyrocket, your heart rate goes up, your brain, you know, your brain takes over in your fight or flight or freeze mode. And if you're not ready for that, then, you know, you don't just show up to stuff like that and rise to the occasion. And I'll be honest, the first time that I got shot at in that scenario where it turned into this 7-minute gunfight was my first shooting. You know, I had that oh shit moment. Fortunately for me, you know, I've always had good guys, officers I've always worked with. I've always mentally trained myself for stuff like that. I've played those scenarios out in my head over and over and over again. And I think that's what got me through it, because in that oh shit moment, I quickly snapped myself out of it. And I went from, you know, being terrified to angry. And I turned that fear into a way to deal with what I needed to do, which was engage this guy. And so we are engaging each other back and forth in this apartment complex. And, you know, there were kids, his kids were involved in this whole ordeal. They came running out of the apartment. So we had to deal with them. And, you know, I ended up, when my partner got there, it gave me the opportunity to go back to my patrol car, which was pretty close by, grab my rifle out of the car, because I'm like, the handgun is staying cutting it on this. So I went and grabbed my rifle and got to a better tactical advantage to get a better shot at this guy when he came down. What he was doing was coming down, he'd fire some rounds at us, go back up, he'd reload his gun, and then engage us again. So I was able to get to a good position, and finally my partner and I, who he had his rifle, we ended up shooting and killing this guy. But you know, just not knowing what to expect after that, after the whole ordeal was done, I was kind of like surreal. It was just like, I just couldn't believe that had just happened. In a way, I mean, you know, I was proud of how we performed and we did our job. But, you know, same with what you just said, you know, I, at the end of it, you know, I was sad and I didn't know if I should feel that way. I was questioning myself, you know, there's kind of like a level of guilt. Like I said, this was a domestic violence call and there were kids involved, and growing up, I grew up in a domestic violence household with my biological father, so it kind of brought me back to that a little bit. And then with the kids and you know, after this whole ordeal, we got the kids out of the apartment that we had put them in for safety. You know, they asked if their dad was dead, and you know, he was. So I just didn't know what to expect, and I didn't talk about it with anybody. I kind of talked about it with my partner that was also in the shooting with me, but I mean, we were never really trained in law enforcement, where to reach out for help. You know, we didn't learn that in the academy. That section got brushed over, the mental health side of stuff. So yeah, I just didn't really know where to go from there, and honestly, I just kind of bottled it in. I didn't really talk about it. You know, my uncle who's sitting behind you, we, you know, I talked about it with him, but because he comes from a law enforcement background, but
also the era of suck it up
and yeah,
the whole, go to the next call.
Yeah. And back then, yeah. You know, the whole mental health thing in law enforcement wasn't really popular back then. It has now become very popular in the last 2 years, I would say, but even back in 2015, it was not talked about. And I can't recall any officer at my department that ever talked about it.
I love how you said that oh shit moment,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it becomes too real to take in. And for those who aren't law enforcement, don't know what we're talking about, it's become so real. It's life and death. It's that fight, you know, flight or mm-hmm. fight syndrome that kicks in. In my shooting 95, like you're talking about, there is no training about afterwards. I didn't go to the range afterwards and familiarize with my gun again. Next time I have to shoot my gun or use my gun, it felt like a hammer in my hand after killing a man. And when after my shooting, I killed this man, I couldn't stop my brain from lapsing these photos just of the scene, of everything going on. Can you talk about that? And your situation may be totally different. And I almost guarantee you, as a listener to this incredible story of yours, your emotional take from the first killing to the last is going to probably be different, because you probably were able to, talking with your great uncle here, you're probably able to deal with a little bit of that. We'll just call it post-traumatic. Totally. Yeah. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, totally. And I did experience that. So the first one, like I said, I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where to turn to. And I was starting to feel a little sense of that. Like, I remember going to SWAT training a few days after the shooting. And, you know, you're off of work, but you're only off of work for like a week, you know, and then you're expected to come back. And I remember going to SWAT training and hearing gunfire as soon as I got there, and it scared the shit out of me. And I've never felt like that.
Triggers.
Around gun. Yeah, absolutely. I had a trigger, right? And I kind of like ducked and flinched. And my buddy, who was a sergeant at the time who drove me out there, he saw that and he's like, shit, are you all right? And I'm like, well, I've never experienced that before. It my heart rate jumped, right? And so, we ended up leaving, and after my second shooting, you know, I believe that was when it was my second shooting, which was a year later. I ended up going to therapy, and I sought out a post-trauma therapy, which was EMDR therapy. And so after my second shooting, I like I said, nobody really guided me in that direction. I just kind of took it upon myself because I noticed a change about myself at work. My mood was different. You know, I was a lot more irritable. I noticed my anxiety was a lot higher at work. Even just a simple, you know, basically a routine call would elevate my heart rate. And, you know, I was just tired of feeling like that, you know, for the last year or so. So after my second shooting, I ended up signing up for EMDR therapy. I did that for about 5-6 months. I did several sessions of that. And that really changed me. It really helped me. It helped me understand post-trauma, how your brain kind of harbors trauma, and really how to connect the bad and the good that we all store in our brains and how to connect those two together. And so that helped me out a lot. And I started spreading the word about it. And so that's kind of how I ended up where I am now doing what I'm doing. But so the difference between the first one and the last one is I was able to handle that stress and the feeling of taking someone's life a lot easier than I did the first time. And what was great about it was after this last one, I told you the guy that I was in it with was just off of training. So he's brand new. I didn't want him to feel the same way I felt. So I made him go out and really push this EMDR therapy on him.
Good.
Right away. You know, I told him, just don't wait. You may not even feel any different right afterwards, but you know, over time, it may kick in and you never know when that's going to happen. So I told him, just go do it. And he did. And he thanks me for doing it. So,
and 2 years later, he's doing,
yeah, he's doing really well.
Doing good?
Okay. Yeah, he's doing really well. We talk about it still every once in a while because, like, you know, I think you can understand that that's just something you don't ever forget.
I don't think you should ever stop talking about it. You're right. You don't ever forget it. I don't think you should ever stop talking about it.
And yeah. It's a bond like no other bond.
It is a bond. Yeah. It's, I mean, when you're in a life and death situation with a partner who is by your side and sticks it out with you, that's a pretty cool feeling. And yeah, that's a. You talk about brotherhood. I mean, it doesn't get any stronger than that.
You know, I think the greatest thing that he just said in that whole conversation, Darren and Jason, is the fact that he suggested going to get the EMDR to the young man, because a lot of times we're taught to just, like you said, Jason, suck it up. But the thing of it is we need to have more open communication, whether it's with family, friends, you know, with our coworkers. I mean, you guys are relying on each other. You got to keep each other's backs. And if you're not able to communicate effectively or even offer that peer advice to be able to open up and talk about that kind of shit, I mean, that to me is just incredible. So yeah. He's lucky that he had you there.
I think, man, just I could sit here and talk to Kyle all day. I have so many questions. I think what is important right now, and I, like you said at the academy, I still teach at our academy. And you're talking to these young people. And I was one of those, when I came out of the academy in 99, I was just gung-ho. Can't believe I got this job. It's what I'm meant to be doing. Taking bad guys to jail. I'm not going to get in a shooting. I'm certainly not going to get in a car accident and catch on fire. None of those things are you thinking about. But two things I want to get your thoughts on. First of all, when you talk about preparing mentally before it happens, does that help you then in the recovery after it happens? And the other thing, again, the nuances of this, your most recent shooting, you're dealing with at first an unarmed guy who you know was or is armed. You've got the possible loss of your dog, whether it be from some asshole killing him or you having to kill your own dog. You're responsible in a lot of ways for this new officer who hasn't been through the stuff you've been through. He's only got a week on. And then reverse it. Can you imagine what he must have been thinking? I don't want to be responsible for the death of a senior officer when I've only got a week on. People lose sight of the human emotion, and we all are going to have different feelings and see different things, right? And yeah. So the recovery is not simply, I was involved in a shooting. I had to take somebody's life. There are 100 other things that you went through, and they might be separate than the 100 things the other officer went through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is important to express to all the officers listening right now who have yet to be in those situations, but very possibly will be. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you are right. And, you know, to answer your first part of the question is yes, 100%. I do think that all that mental preparation is going to help you in the aftermath. And educating yourself on post-trauma, knowing how your brain handles it, and then how to treat it, yes, it's definitely going to help on the back end. Because like I said, I did have a level of guilt, like you were saying. And I learned that, you know, it's okay to have empathy, and you should. We all should have empathy.
Yes.
But we shouldn't feel guilty about the decisions that we had to make. And so I learned to know the difference between feeling guilty and having empathy, and it's vastly different. You know, I always tell people, every time my dog bit somebody, right, it's very painful. That's traumatic for somebody. I mean, honestly, it's kind of traumatic as an officer to see an animal basically mauling somebody.
Yes.
That's not normal to see in and of itself. But when you had to use your dog, you had to deploy him, whatever, you know, and you get a dog bite. And so many times I remember sitting in the hospital or going to the hospital and interviewing some of these guys after my dog bit them. And usually they're super cool after the fact, right? I mean, most of the time they're like, that was so awesome. Your dog is badass. You know, I can only imagine the pain that they're in. And I had a level of empathy for these guys. And I'd be like, dude, why didn't you just give up, right? And most of the time it was the answer you'd always get is, I didn't really think you were going to let the dog bite me. And it's like, okay, well, what the fuck? What'd you think I was going to, you know?
Well, that's what's great about it. Criminals are stupid. That's what's
I wasn't joking when I said the dog is going to find and bite you. That's not a joke. But my point behind it is I learned to grow a level of empathy for these people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're criminals and made a bad decision and whatever. But, you know, so having empathy in this job, if you're a cop listening and you're feeling like you have that and you're questioning yourself if that's okay or not, it's 100% acceptable. You should have it. You know, we need to be treating people with respect and dignity, right? Whether someone did something right or wrong, we're not better than anybody. We just simply have a job to do. And as long as we're doing it professionally, treat people with respect. You know, it's okay to have empathy. You know, it's going to make you feel better, I think. And when you're involved in a traumatic event, I think it just helps with the recovery process. Now, I think the second part of your comment or question, you know, mentally preparing yourself for something like that, not being naive and thinking that that's not going to happen to you, you know, because if you have that mindset, when it happens, you're going to be the officer that's either running away, freezing, potentially getting killed because you're not doing what you should be doing.
Yes.
Or in some of the cases, like we were talking before the show about the officer that thought she pulled her taser but pulled her gun.
In Minneapolis, yes.
Okay.
Just that, outside.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, but that stuff happens because they're under so much stress that they can't work through that stress, and they're doing something they ordinarily wouldn't do if they were not under stress. Now, to beat that, you have to do, I'm a very big proponent of doing some type of stress-induced training with officers. Okay, so now I'm a sergeant. You know, I run our briefings. You know, being a canine handler, I have keys and access to a bunch of vacant buildings throughout the city, right? So what I like to do is I'll go get a couple officers who I know are senior squared away guys, have them put civilian clothes on. I'll go set up a scenario. I bought my own blank gun for training, $100. And I will go set a scenario up. I will call the officers during their briefing time. They won't know what's coming. And I'll say, meet me at this location. And I will put them in some type of stress-induced scenario. You know, and being able to work through being a little bit of nervous, or you're, you know, if you show up to your department training and you know it's scenario day and your heart rate's kind of elevated and you're like, I don't want to do it because I don't want to look like an idiot in front of the proctors, whoever that may be. That is the best time to do the scenario because you're already a little bit stressed out. If you can go in there and you do that scenario, whether you completely screw the scenario up or not, being able to work through it, you know, that's the time when you can go back and fix your mistakes or whatever. But
yeah, it's a good time to fail.
That is the perfect time to fail. Yes. Yeah, that's like the only time you get to fail. Because outside of that, it's the consequences are could be death.
Right.
You know, so I'm a very big proponent of doing stress-induced training, especially with the younger officers. Whether they like it or not, you know, I make them do it. And, you know, they're going to benefit from that, you know, because when something cracks off and it's going to be amplified by 1,000, you know, they're going to be able to work through that a lot easier than the average officer that just shows up to work every day, does his job, doesn't think anything's going to happen to him, and has a mentality of, well, I'm going to go to work, do my 10 or 12-hour day and go home. That's a bad mentality to have. You're a cop. You don't get to have that opportunity. That's not the way to think.
Right.
So I did a lot of that going in before my first shooting. That's just how I was brought up, and my field training officers kind of ingrained that in me. And, you know, I just kind of lucked out in having solid partners throughout my career, really good mentors, and I really truly believe that's what got me through that first incident. And then, you know, for whatever reason, it seemed like after that first shooting, it was like boom, another one.
Yeah, seriously.
It was like nonstop.
You know, talk about getting through that incident, and I love what you said about as a supervisor. You're the type of supervisor people want to work for, quite frankly. And you see it in your men and women. I guarantee you see it, don't you? When they come in, and because they need to be prepared. They need the realism. They need to understand that. And it kind of goes to a question. You partially answered it. There's a difference between your boss and a leader, true supervisor. Mine, in my shooting, never showed up at the scene. Never, never. I know. Wow. You look at me like, how the F could that happen, right?
Yeah.
They're out there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What would you say to those sergeants, those supervisors, your colleagues? And again, I'm not pointing at any department. I'm not pointing at the guy who failed me. But they're out there, unfortunately. What would you say to them?
Yeah, you know, part of the reason I promoted to sergeant, you know, I was in canine. That's like the best gig in the
department.
There's
no better gig.
Yeah, it really was. And I really felt like I only had such an impact being a dog handler to be an informal leader and to want to train folks because I really started going that direction. It became a passion. I felt like I needed to promote to the next level because as a sergeant, you have such an influence over these officers that work for you. So that's why I ended up promoting to sergeant. I wanted to have a bigger impact on these officers. And so, you know, if you're a supervisor out there who's not engaging with your officers in trainings and in showing up to their calls and not micromanaging, but just watching how they handle calls and let them fail on calls as long as it's not, you know, a violation of policy or the law or they're not going to get themselves hurt or killed. You know, let them figure it out, you know, because that's how we learn. You know, so don't micromanage. But, you know, pulling these officers aside after these calls, it may be minor and it may be a big incident, but debriefing the calls with them and just, you know, asking them, hey, why'd you do it this way? Or maybe they'll offer a little piece of your advice from your experience. You know, you could have done it this way and maybe it would have worked out. But I always say as long as the officer can get through the call, you know, from A to Z, however long it takes them, if they have their own way of doing it, it may not be my way. You know, I'm fine with that, but you do have to be engaged with your officers and you have to know how they're operating, know how they're thinking, because when you're listening to them on the radio, maybe they're in a car chase or a foot chase or, you know, some type of incident where it's high stress. If you don't know your officers and kind of know their skill level, you know, then there's a lack of trust. And How can you trust them to make the right decisions if you don't even know really their capabilities?
Well, they're not cookie cutter robots. And you bring up a great example. It's just like if you think of a sports team, people do it different. Some are slower, some are faster, some are bigger and stronger, some are smaller. And that's completely okay. Everybody has has their place on the team. And it is a team thing when you're out there. Obviously, a lot of calls you go on alone or traffic stops. But when you think about things like your shooting, your most recent one, your first one, there were multiple people. People have their strengths and weaknesses, and that can be beneficial if it's not criticized by a supervisor.
Yeah, you know, I'm definitely not a fan of the whole micromanaging and criticizing in a harsh way. If I'm doing it, it's to teach them something. But and what I stress very highly, especially to the newer officers, is do all the small things right, and you know when the big thing happens, you're going to be so much better off.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times cops want to skip over all the little stuff and basic tactics and stuff like that, and they only want to train themselves for the big event. You know that has its place, but you really got to prepare yourself for all the little stuff too, right? Like basic tactics. Where are you parking on calls? You know, are you looking for some type of hard cover when you're walking up to a house? Because it may be a routine call, it may go to shit really fast, and I've experienced that too many times now where damn, every call I go on, I'm looking around and just seeing where can I go to cover if someone starts
shooting. Things don't go to shit slowly.
No.
They do. They go to shit.
0 to 100.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So
I'm glad you bring that up.
So I can't stress enough, and as a supervisor, you know, you really have a big play in this, is teaching your folks that do all the little things right. You know, tactics, debriefing calls, you know, that's going to prepare you for the big event.
You know, I don't know about you, Jason, but, you know, 30 years of police work, but I've been removed now 7 years. And Jason, you've been removed probably longer.
16 years.
And I still drive defensively. Mm-hmm. I look for avenues out. And this mindset as a police officer, you know, is so huge to understand your environment. It's when you talk to a civilian and say, you know, you should always know your environment, it means something totally different as a police officer, completely. Yeah. And now you're not just teaching your men and women this. You're not just helping colleagues. You're doing other things and teaching outside your department with different conferences. Can you speak to this and what you're doing?
Yeah, so after my fourth shooting, you know, I really wanted to kind of get out there and teach other cops outside of just my department. So I started just traveling around doing mental health type stuff, talking about post-trauma and all that. I had a friend die 1 week after my fourth shooting. He was actually, when I had to go to the hospital after my fourth shooting just to get checked out, and he was a cop in another jurisdiction. We grew up together as kids, and he ended up showing up. He heard everything over the radio. He ends up showing up at the hospital and hanging out with me for 2 hours, which is a little bittersweet because that actually ended up being the last time I saw him. But, you know, we were talking back and forth about getting, you know, a beer after doing my interview with the detectives or whatever a week after the fact. And he was struggling with his own mental health issues and never talked about it. You know, I knew a little bit about it, but he kept it in, and he was in the military. And so there was a lot going on with him. And 1 week to the day of that shooting, he lost his life. And so I really took that serious about, I wish I would have talked to him more about the EMDR therapy I did, but because, like I said, it wasn't really talked about, and it wasn't too big of a deal. Like, I was embarrassed that I had even done it. And so I kind of kept it in my small circle. And I if I would have just talked to him about it, I feel like maybe he could have gone and got that type of help. And maybe it would have helped him. You know, I don't know. But I took it pretty serious after that. I'm like, I have this knowledge and experience. I want to spread it to everybody I possibly can, because I know there's so many cops out there that are struggling with those types of issues. And so it's just kind of started with me going around to local agencies for free, just talking to their department about post-trauma and what EMDR therapy is, because nobody usually knows about it. And it's designed for post-trauma. You know, so why they don't teach that stuff in the academies and, you know, why more cops don't know about it is mind-boggling to me. So that was my goal. Travel around, talk about mental health, whatever. And then it kind of evolved into, you know, then guys were hitting me up and asking me about, you know, tactics and shoot, you know, how to prepare yourself for shootings and OISs and stuff, and, you know, what it's like to be in one. And so then I kind of created this class. Surviving Deadly Encounters is what I called it. But it turned into this eight-hour class that I do now, and it's just it starts out with the mental health side of things, and then I debrief all four of my shootings, and then I talk about, okay, now here's how you survive these things, what to expect when going to a critical incident, proper training to get your mind right for something like that, you know, and then kind of what to expect if you are in an OIS, like post OIS, you know, emotions, just what to expect after the fact. So turned out to be a really good thing. You know, I've got to travel around now to several different states and do it. And now, you know, I've kind of turned that into an actual business now, a training business, where, you know, I'm trying to get more instructors on with me and travel around and just teach different topics, you know, like advanced patrol tactics or, you know, canine tactics, some SWAT stuff. And kind of branch out from there. So it's been really cool. Kind of just took off. But really, yeah, it's just using my experience, real life experience, and using it to teach people.
Kyle, in closing this segment, and definitely want you to stay around for the next segment because you're going to be an expert to talk on this. I got a few things to say in closing, but first, how can people get a hold of you? For the officers out there who want this training, or hopefully some supervisors out there who want to collectively get this training, how can we find you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram. I use it for my business, okay. And it's just Kyle_Schoberg. So Kyle_Schoberg, Schoberg. You can find me on Instagram, and you can find where I'm doing some of these classes if you'd like to attend, or if you want to host a class. I have a website you can go to, www.kyleschoberg.com. Okay. You can get a course flyer on there. You can sign up to register for a class. And then I recently started my own podcast with a good buddy of mine who's on a fugitive apprehension team. He's got a wealth of experience. So we started doing our own podcast, which is a Shots Fired podcast.
Nice.
So you can find that on any of your podcast platforms, or we're also on YouTube. So it's all on video.
Outstanding.
So you can find us there. But mainly I operate off my Instagram. And yeah, if anybody's
it's a great
interested,
platform.
Great. Oh, it's I mean, excellent for marketing.
That's almost all I use exclusively, and Darren, LinkedIn, and stuff like that. But we'll help get your name out there. I can't thank you enough. I'm humbled, and you are. This is not a cliche, but you are a cop's cop. You obviously take care of yourself, physically, mentally. You're incredibly well spoken. I know you're young. I hope that. You finish out your career the way you want to, but then don't ever stop. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at your uncle, and I would happily go into any dark alley with this guy. And I don't know how old he is now, but he still could take care of business has taken care of himself. So you obviously come from a good bloodline in that fact. But I can't thank you enough, because this is what we need in law enforcement right now. Is we could clone and have 10,000 Kyle Schobergs out there, we'd be a lot better off
of ways. A lot
the
safer.
Community would be a lot better off.
We mean it when we say we can sit here and talk with you for an hour. So please come back to the show. Please. Open invite,
so,
my friend.
We will be right back with, I'm sure, a segment where me and Darren will have a tiny bit of disagreement, and we'll have a little fun with that in the cop talk. So come on back in just a few minutes.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Pete James, a retired law enforcement officer who has a passion for the safety and security of those in the profession. OfficerPrivacy.com offers a full range of privacy services that removes your personal information from the internet so you and your family can feel safe and secure in your home. OfficerPrivacy.com will keep you safe.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Oh, man. I'm so glad Kyle's sticking around for this next segment. That truly was just an incredible, and it, you know, selfishly, I'm speaking to the largest police summit of the year tomorrow morning. And it's a 3-day conference, the Wounded Blue. And it's going to be full of people like Kyle. But it's going to be full of people who have gone through critical incidents. Or not only at the
survivors.
Very end, at the very end, Kyle, and I don't mean this at all the way I'm going to say it, but he casually throws in at the end, well, a week later, I lost my friend. Gee, that is an incredibly big deal.
Yeah.
And so I just can't even tell you how humbled and inspired I am to now go up there tomorrow and look at these faces, understanding I don't know what you've been through. And I can tell you my story. I can tell you how I overcame it. But everybody has their own story. And you can overcome it. You can get through it. And you can continue to do what's my favorite thing? Leave the day better than you found it. And that's what Kyle is doing every single day, even through this trauma. And what we're seeing right now with 160 suicides so far this year, the alcoholism, the domestic violence that doesn't get talked about, the people who are quitting, the line of duty deaths. It truly is an epidemic, and I hate even saying that word, but to sit here and listen to somebody like Kyle gives me so much hope, and it's just a great reminder of why we're doing what we're doing. And I know we're going to talk about again, I'm probably going to be devil's advocate here, Darren. I know you're fired up about this next topic.
I really
am. It's horrible and it's tragic, but it is the hot topic of the week. So serve it up. Alec Baldwin killed somebody on the set of a movie.
Yeah, and we're talking criminal. I really do believe this. And I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about, I think I have unique qualifications in weighing in here, because there's people that are going to weigh in because they just hate Alec Baldwin. There's going to be people weighing in here because they love Alec Baldwin. That doesn't matter. Your feelings about that man absolutely have no factor in this situation. I've been in films, as Robin knows, and there is a protocol. After Brandon Lee was killed through a tragic accident, and I would say accident in that scenario, there was a protocol through a Screen Actors Guild. They have a policy. And as police officers, we know if you deviate from policy, well, you're starting to go into the negligence realm. And that's one of the first things they look at. Were you following policy and procedures? If not, why not? And there is times where you don't. You know, if there's a situation where there's a guy with a gun and I'm in my car and he's going to shoot at someone, yeah, I'm going to do vehicular intervention. You know, I'm going to run him over to stop him. I can use lethal force. You know, you think outside the box, even though policy says you will not use your vehicle. No, in that situation, I will. So what I taught when I'm so angry at looking at the social media at this, because again, people are weighing in on a political platform and not on
because all that people care about right
yes.
now.
Yes, and what we have here is somebody was killed that should not have been killed. You talk about leaving the day better than you found it. Alec Baldwin did not do that, and he did not do that because of his own negligence. The first and foremost thing that makes him responsible in negligence is when someone hands you a gun, a real gun, and you treat it as what?
A real gun.
Every weapon is loaded. Yeah.
Every weapon
is
loaded.
You treat a weapon as it's loaded. And he failed because he did not check it. And there's a protocol. There's an armor involved. There's all these safety measures. And the last safety measure, which is the most important safety measure, is checking the damn gun to make sure there's not either a projectile or an actual real bullet. Regardless, at some assistant director, and Robin will attest to this, assistant directors are referred to as what in the industry? Their initials are...
Well, they're backseat drivers, pretty much. They're not involved in that part.
They're called ADs.
Yeah.
They're ADs. And please, we know what AD is, an actual discharge. And that's what happened, because this idiot hands Alec Baldwin the gun, as not as an armor, but as a AD, as the assistant director, hands him a gun and says it's cold. In the industry, cold gun means that it's one, it's either no projectile whatsoever is in it, no bullet,
it's empty.
Completely empty, or it's a dummy round. But it doesn't mean there's a blank in it. And that's what killed, sadly, Brandon Lee. There was a blank, and then there was a projectile of some kind
of alien.
That
was launched in it. There was a fragment that was launched in, and the
and
powder...
That became a projectile.
Right.
As
I remember that case very well, and
exactly. Nothing
should have ever happened
right.
after that.
In this case, again, the jury's still out, and there's a lot of investigation going forward, but it looks like there was a bullet removed from the actual director in... at the scene of this shooting with Alec Baldwin. So when we talk about his negligence, Alec Baldwin, you look at he's the one who pulled the trigger. He's the one who didn't check the gun when it was given to him. But more importantly, did you know that hours before this shooting, the crew walked off?
All the unionized crew.
And you know why they walked off? Why did they walk off?
Unsafe working conditions.
Yep. That, again, shows the culpability of negligence, where they know there's an issue, and there was no armor. So they've already violated their own protocol. There's so many aspects of this that should have stopped that girl, young lady, from being killed.
Well, I will say this, and obviously this comes from a personal standpoint. Everything is definitely politicized, and I want to preface this with I am definitely in the camp of... I fucking hate Alec Baldwin. The guy is disgusting with how he treats
other
people.
But that doesn't matter, does it?
And I am incredibly sad for the woman, Helena, I think is how you say her name, her husband, her son. She lost her life. But the karma of the fact that this happened to Alec Baldwin goes to show you, you know what, all that shit you talked all those years, and it can still happen to you, so stop blaming other people. Aside from that personal thing, Alec Baldwin, he might, this is where I'm going to disagree with you, Darren. He might have some culpability on the civil side, financial side, as the producer of the film.
Mm-hmm.
When
yes.
it comes to the actual scene, it's easy for us. It's easy for me and you and Kyle to sit here and say, don't point a gun at anything you don't intend to shoot, because that's what we were trained. Don't ever put your finger on a trigger if you don't intend to fire that weapon. Alec Baldwin, again, whether you like him or not, is an excellent actor. He has been in hundreds of movies. He does not like guns. He is not a guns rights advocate. As the actor in that scene, I do not find him to have any culpability in that he, outside of asking, which he did, and he was told, this gun is cold. And there are movies being filmed every day, thousands of them, and this doesn't happen. This is an incredibly rare event. So I don't see that there should be any criminal charges against Alec Baldwin. Now, for the assistant director, for the prop firearm girl who's 22 years old, that's you have one job. You have one job to make sure that the guns are safe. And there's different levels that they use for props, different levels of blanks that will make the gun appear more real, make the sounds, depending on what scene they're shooting. This particular scene, there's absolutely no way that that gun should not have been cold when Alec Baldwin was told it was. So I don't blame him at all for the death of the girl, even though he pulled the trigger. And that they still won't release what she was shot with. We don't know what, like with the,
well, we know it's an old style,
but like with
revolver.
Bruce Lee's son Brandon,
it was a
when
period
he was
piece.
Killed. A lot of people don't know this. It somebody had used that gun for real, you know, weeks prior, and a fragment got lodged in the end, which would have been hard to discover. Then they put a dummy round in. The powder pushed the fragment out, and unfortunately, the actor, who has never been the same, who fired that blank, and he was standing very, very close to Brandon Lee. It truly was a tragic accident, and then we thought that this could never happen again. Now it has happened, and at the end of the day, what matters is Helena is dead, her son is going to grow up without his mom, and it should not have happened.
Not only should not have happened, but in my opinion, Alec Baldwin is criminally culpable for it happening for many reasons.
Okay.
First of all, he was producer. Producer is very different depending on producers. When you watch a film, there are so many producers, the executive producer. Mm-hmm. Some people are producers simply because they are the big actor and they get some points and they get producer credit. Dean Martin got that chance in the film Airport. So it goes way back how people are producers. He was actually the producer of the film. Mm-hmm. Producers of the film are responsible for everything other than the actors. So he's responsible for the armor. He's responsible for the safety. He's responsible for all those facets that failed Mrs. Hutchins.
Right.
Absolutely. She died because he failed as a producer. He failed as an actor. After Brandon Lee, there was a call to arms, no pun intended, regarding policy and procedures as right. it relates to armor. Right. They have to have an armor on set. As a producer, he failed there.
But he chose one who didn't know what she was doing. She's 22 years old.
And that should not have been cutting costs. Right. And armor is an actual experienced firearm expert. As a producer, he's cutting costs. He's responsible for who that armor was, or was that not a real armor? We need to know more information about that armor.
You're
but
right.
Regardless,
though,
it failed as a producer because that person should not have been in that role. The next thing we're talking about is one job. The neat thing about Brandon Lee's death is it changed the canvas of films. And again, they have the entire set of policy. The very last check and balance, and there's like seven checks and balances. Mm-hmm. The last check and balance is the actor himself. So now let's look at Alec Baldwin, not as political, but as the experienced 63-year-old actor who's been in film since he was in his 20s, and many of those were action films with the
many
use of guns. He, above anyone else, should have known that you, and it's policy. Again, if we hold police to that standard, when you are involved in an incident and you're deviating from policy, bam, you're already negligent based on the failure of the policy. And
I gotta speak
up
here.
Check that gun.
I have to speak up here because you, as an actor on set with firearms, you are not responsible to check. And they tell you this when you're on set. In between each take, the person in charge of the weapons comes over and they work with the actor. They take the weapon from the actor. They clear anything that's supposed to be there. And then they reload for the next shot if we're using blanks. I have been behind a gun many times in productions. I have also been in front of a bullet in many times during productions. And it's really scared me because I look at all the people that aren't doing these double checks. And every time I've been on set, the person who is in charge of the firearms will go through the firearms at least a dozen times before the shot takes place. And they will walk the actor through the safety of the weapon. They will teach the actor, even if we're experienced with firearms, they will teach us how we hold it. A lot of times it's shot, the camera is shot at a different angle so that the firearm is not directly placed within fire line of the intended victim of the bullet. And being on both ends of the sides of that, being the person with the gun and the person being shot, I can attest to the fact that protocol was not being followed, because in the end, it doesn't rely on the actor to check the firearm, but the armor person is supposed to be right by that actor's side, showing them and opening the chamber, checking everything out, pulling the clip out if it's a semi-automatic, you know, or everything. You're supposed to work with them hand in hand. So where was the armor? The armor was not by his side.
And what's unique about this is what you're saying was accurate, with the exception of this actor was the producer. He was he's the one who hired the armor. He's the one that's responsible ultimately for the armor's actions.
Right.
There was no armor. I'm sorry, assistant director has a job, and armor is not that job.
No.
Alec Baldwin was producer. He's ultimately responsible, and he pulled that trigger knowing there's no armor, knowing that he's allowed this escape of policy and procedure. That is negligence to the nth degree.
Yes.
And on top of all that, he squeezed that trigger and ended a life.
I agree with you on that. I'm just saying it's protocol to have the armor check
and
the weapon.
And we have an expert in our midst. What? And again, you may not know anything about the acting world. I'm going to assume you don't.
No.
So, but in terms of someone handing you a gun, squeeze that trigger, I'm looking at, you know, is it accidental? Is it reckless? Is it negligent? Is it, you know, willful intent? In this case, I really think it's negligent. I think it rises to that level. How do you feel?
I think when you look in the lens of a cop with a firearm and a civilian who's obviously anti-firearm, and you hand that person a firearm, you know, they're not going to know anything, how to clear it, check it, you know. So in the sense of, you know, what Jason's saying, I can understand his point of view, and do we blame him for just trusting the expert who handed him the firearm, who told him it was cold? Obviously now if you hand one of us a firearm and I know that I'm going to point it at another human being and pull the trigger, I'm going to check that gun probably three times and then have probably two other people check it as well to make sure it is cold. I think more importantly is I think he's going to have a very difficult time probably for the rest of his life now. I mean,
I don't think he'll ever act again.
I feel horrible for him.
Oh, he'll never act again.
I think he's going to be traumatized.
He's got like six kids under the age of 13. He'll never be the same father. There's going to be so much tragedy out of this whole thing.
There's going to be a huge fallout for Alec Baldwin out of this whole ordeal. Yeah. Whether he gets goes to jail, gets prosecuted, you know, whatever that the outcome of that is, you know, we don't know what that's going to be. Obviously, they're going to have to do a long, in-depth investigation, because it sounds to me like there's a lot that goes involved in this that there probably is. The average public doesn't just know about.
Thank you.
Literally, as we're sitting here, breaking news.
Is the
assistant director
on
the set admitted in the search warrant that he gun failed. Safety mistakes were made. So that
he's hired by Alec Baldwin. Here's the last thing.
Again, I agree with you.
I'll leave it on this as far as my take on it. Precedent has been set. Famous actors, famous directors have been charged with wrongful death, civilly as well as criminally. John Landis.
Yes.
Killed Vic Morrow. He actually went to criminal trial. Yes. So I would not be surprised that we see criminal charges.
I would advocate for that in this sense, and this is where it does become political, because you know nothing in this world I hate more than hypocrisy. But at the end of the day, we're talking about lives being lost, right? So we brought up earlier the 25-year veteran police officer in just outside of Minneapolis who thought she drew her taser. You could see it on body cam. You could hear her immediately like, oh, shit, I thought I had my taser. I think I shot him. And she has been charged. She is awaiting trial for accidentally killing somebody. Was it negligent? Yes. By definition of the law, is she guilty of manslaughter? I would probably say yes. And because I'm not just going to sit here and bleed blue and be like, oh, mistakes are mistakes. No. But the hypocrisy, this would not have happened. Alec Baldwin, as a producer, he hates police officer. He hates the NRA. He hates the military. If you could set aside your hatred and still hire the experts, this would never happen.
And he should have.
And so the hypocrisy of if he does not get charged as a producer or the armorer who was inexperienced, but you still charge a police officer in Minnesota for accidentally pulling her taser, that's where I do think there's a serious problem. But in the political world we live in right now and who's running the country, what Alec Baldwin did, oh, it's just a sad, tragic mistake. What that Minnesota cop did, she's a horrible person. She's evil. She meant to kill him. She's a racist, and she better go to jail. And that's the divisiveness in this. And we're not even close to the depths of how bad we're going to get.
I had a quick question. Yeah, please. Was it a bullet or where
they,
did the bullet
they have
from?
Not they have not released that yet.
I was going to say I don't remember reading anything about that.
No, they haven't released what the
projectile was.
And you know what? Until it comes from the coroner or the district attorney's office, I don't think anybody should speculate.
Authorities in New Mexico say they have recovered a bullet believed to have been fired from the gun held by Alec Baldwin on the Rust film set last week. The announcement comes 6 days after the actor fired a gun that was thought to be safe while rehearsing
the scene.
Where
did they recover it from?
That is from Santa Fe County Sheriff. It was from his body. The director.
He was shot in the clavicle, and according to the reports, he was standing behind her.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because she was a center
of through.
She was so that would make sense. But again, until the coroner
is all preliminary.
I'd like to believe Santa Fe, but
the word bullet was from Sheriff Adam Mendoza, said a lead projectile considered to be the bullet was recovered. Again, that's early. That lead projectile, as we know, lead projectiles fired end up flattening out and all sorts of things and change their shape. There's still a lot left to be seen. But I tell you, it's a good conversation to have because we went almost 30 years after Brandon Lee. We'll go another 30 years more.
You're going to see CGI gunfire. I guarantee you.
Brandon Lee's family are advocates for real guns on the set.
You're going to see that
happen.
And there's
no better advocate.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to come back with a much lighter note with a heroic headline that I bet will surprise Darren this week.
Oh, good.
Looney Laws and my favorite song, and then a great inspirational close. Come on back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
OfficerPrivacy.com is offering a special deal for listeners of this podcast. This is a great deal. Go to OfficerPrivacy.com/BB
Their team of current and retired law enforcement officers will remove your information from the top three sites that are showing your home address, phone number, and more. Sign up at officerprivacy.com/BB. You can also follow the link on our show notes.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Jason, I think you hit a home run here. You really did. You brought in this incredible expert with weapons, having been in four shootings. We talked about Alec Baldwin with such passion. It was just a great show, great guest, great job, Jason.
There are always great shows, but this one, yeah, definitely. It's been amazing to have Kyle here and these topics. Moving on to the heroic headline, I'm going to completely go away from law enforcement and probably surprise you, Darren, because you know we usually talk very badly about, or I do anyway, about athletes and athletes.
There's a we.
And the character.
We got a good one this week?
That is on display. However, did you see what happened in the Buccaneers game on Sunday?
No.
There was a little boy, and he looks like he's about 10 or 11, and he's holding a sign that said, "Tom Brady, help me beat brain cancer."
Aww.
And somebody must have gotten word to Tom Brady on the sidelines, and at the end of the game, there is a beautiful video of Tom Brady running up to this young man, putting his hat on this little kid's head, and the reaction from this kid is incredible. So not only is the hero the young boy for him and his doctors for overcoming brain cancer at that age, but Tom Brady definitely left that little boy better than he found him for many reasons by giving him that hat and using his platform for something that is life-changing. And that kid is going to go on to do great things because of that one moment in time. So my hero for this week, as much as it may shock you, is Tom Brady. And I am by no means a Patriots fan or a Tom Brady fan, but
like
what
Tom.
He did, I would
He's
consider him.
I like Tom.
I would
yeah.
consider
I like
him a hero. So,
no, good
have
one.
You found some more ridiculous laws
there
from across
so
our country?
There are so many, buddy. Right. It's very, very easy. Yeah, they may have made sense when they were written, but today these laws are just questionable or just plain loony. They're in every state, and here's the next set of loony laws. God, I love that tune. In New York, there's a law that allows for an extra sales tax for slicing bagels. That's right. If you order a sliced bagel in New York City, you'll have to pay more for it. There's an eight-cent tax for altered.
They call it being lazy. Cut it yourself.
No. It's a, quote, altered bagels. And that includes sliced, toasted, served with cream cheese and other adornments. But uncut bagels are exempt from this altered bagel law. It's a good thing they don't actually have like a tax for Big Apples in the Big Apple. And maybe if we tax enough bagel eaters, then maybe we can get all those police department cuts reinstated, you think? So keep eating sliced bagels, New Yorkers, please. We need a real police, fully armed police department. In Oklahoma, it's against the law to trip horses and wrestle bears. That's right. In Oklahoma, it's illegal to promote, engage in, or be employed by a horse-tripping event. It is also unlawful to wrestle a bear. Now, apparently, too many bears and horses have been complaining, I guess. I mean,
I would encourage the bear wrestling because I know who's going to win. And I just agree, that's stupid.
And it's a one-time offender, right? It's a one-time offender. You're not going to be
stupid. Yeah. Then go ahead.
There's not going to be recidivism.
Didn't they used to do that in, like, those roadside carnivals years ago?
Yes. The tripping horses is just wrong.
That is wrong.
Leave the horses alone.
In North Dakota, it is illegal to set fireworks at midnight. So, for New York fireworks celebrations in Devil's Lake, North Dakota fireworks celebrations in Devil's Lake are illegal. So, for the New Year's fireworks celebrations, they can't have it, despite a 1999 amendment which allowed the sale of fireworks temporarily from December 26th through January 1st. It's still illegal to set off fireworks. Now, fireworks, I don't think they care what time they're set off. I don't think they're any more dangerous or less dangerous if it's, you know, 11:59 opposed to midnight. So,
well, some lawmaker did and stood up and said, we're going to make this a bill, and he got it passed. So,
yeah, yeah.
Grumpy old men.
And our last two loony laws are pretty bad. In North Carolina, it is a felony to steal grease. Yep, not automotive grease, but fast food restaurant grease. It is a felony to steal more than $1,000 worth of grease, and a misdemeanor if it's less than $1,000. Grease theft, it turns out, was a huge problem in North Carolina before this 2012 law passed, with midnight grease bandits persistently stealing large vats of restaurant grease. And apparently there was these biodiesel companies were also purchasing restaurants' excessive oil to convert into fuel. Apparently you can convert into fuel. And this makes complete sense to me because I absolutely have gas at fast food places.
Oh my God. Darren, I'm quitting.
Oh, it gets worse, trust me.
No, turn it off. I'm quitting. This is a family
this
show.
This is a classic movie.
This is a family.
Blazing Saddles. Classic film. Blazing Saddles. Yes. Yes.
Good Lord.
Thank you so much, my beautiful Robin Goethe.
Okay, should we cut this one
off? Turn it off!
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Hopefully you were able to hear
I'm
right,
ask,
Jason.
Like five times.
He was going crazy.
Oh, it's
speaking of gassy shits, in Ohio, it's against the law for coal mines to have an inadequate supply of toilet paper. That's right. Operators of underground coal mines must provide an adequate supply of toilet paper with each toilet. You know, apparently, before the law, the coal miners just didn't give a shit.
Darren, you've ruined it. A perfectly good show. Robin, I'm going to ask you nicely to turn this off. God
yeah,
bless America.
Yeah, when I heard this clip today, I was like, Jesus, dear.
Yeah,
and you jumped the shark.
Yes, thank you, Blazing Saddles. Thank you, Dumb and Dumber, for those classic clips of farting and pooping.
And thank you to all of our listeners who will never listen again for joining us for
and
these 2.5 years.
Is the Loony Laws. And again, my job is to take us in the bowels.
Oh,
and
my God.
It's Jason's job
and
to
you did.
Take us out of the bowel and something, again, inspirational.
Think how I felt when I downloaded that.
I found a story that just inspired me so much because this is the definition of why you do your job the right way or you help somebody else out because you never know. You know, we always talk karma has all of our addresses, and a lot of times it's bad karma that's going to get you when you are an asshole, but if you are a good person and do things right, you just never know. And this story goes all the way back to 1981. A pediatrician named Michael Shannon saved the life of a 3.2-pound premature little boy named Chris Troche. He worked around the clock and beat the odds. And think, Darren, of what medicine was like in 1981 versus what it is today. He saved the life of this little boy. And then fast forward 30 years, that pediatrician was trapped and pinned inside of his burning vehicle. And the EMS person who rescued him was Chris Troche.
No way.
I read this and didn't believe it. I had to research it. I'm like, this is an urban legend and bullshit.
It's true. Wow.
It's dead ass true.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
No.
Talk about things coming full circle for both of those gentlemen.
Believe it or not.
Hey, believe in good karma, believe in faith, and just do right by other people. You never know when it's going to come back to you'll get your thanks in a big way. Thank you. Another great show. Kyle, cannot thank you enough. We're definitely going to have you back. I know you got to get back to work in California, but I appreciate you flying over here, being in studio. Truly an honor to meet you.
Yeah,
I
thank
wish
you, guys.
Absolutely.
I wish you the best, and just please, on behalf of people like me who wish that they could still be out there, just keep doing what you're doing and making law enforcement better and just the way it's supposed to be, the way we think that it is. Aside from the news and social media, you are the epitome of law enforcement. And I have thank so you. Much respect for you. So thank you. And God bless everybody. Be safe. We will see you next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.